Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Clifford Cantacarm, and we're going to talk about chemtrails. Clifford has studied this, probably one of the world's experts on this phenomenon of chemical trails, this the spraying which is being done all across the world. And of course, if you've never seen it, you're going to find this is difficult to believe. But Clifford, how did you get involved in studying chemtrails?
Good evening, Dr. Monteith. Very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you again tonight. And in terms of how I became involved, at the simplest level, it began with a direct observation of the sky above me. Back in the very early part of 1999, my wife and I would frequently go out on the weekends, and she's a photographer, and we had a period of several weeks where we would wake up in the morning and we would notice it's very, very clear, beautiful southwestern sky. I live in the high deserts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is known for its clear skies, at least in the past. And we would wake up and things were just beautiful and we would have breakfast. And about an hour and a half later or so, we'd go to head out and we would start to notice that the sky had transformed with no real basis in terms of meteorology or storms or anything like that. And this actually happened for close to 3 weeks to a month before there was a visual recognition on one morning. That was on Valentine's Day, 1999, when an aircraft happened to be flying directly overhead as we were getting ready to go. And it was clear blue at the time we were leaving. And literally, I just stopped there and I just watched this time, and that's what's different. I just stopped to watch because I could see that this was very different than anything I had seen in my history of growing up. I'm 51 years old now. And over the next 20 to 30 minutes, the sky was literally transformed in front of our eyes, and it was directly a result of the aircraft activity. There was nothing else. There was no moisture system coming in. And it was a point of recognition. I think at a subconscious level, there were some things happening for many weeks, and in fact, as I look back in retrospect, there are ties that go back several years, back to 1995 up in the northwest in Montana. By that being a naturally cloudy environment, a direct observation of the change is not so apparent.
Well, now,
from that, From that moment on, when I started taking photographs, it never stopped from that point on. I was committed towards putting a stop to this activity as best as I was able to as a citizen.
And, of course, many people have actually seen the planes flying back and forth. Now, of course, you can see a plane flying from point A to point B, but from going back and forth and back and forth across the sky, when people see this, they begin to realize that somebody is actually doing spraying. You'll begin to see the complexion of the sky changes. This is not a condensation trail. It's a chemical trail. And it's a massive spraying program. There are government records talking about this, but the last thing they want the American people to know, I believe, is that there's another gigantic experiment being carried out. What are the long-range implications? We're going to talk about that when we get back here in just a moment, here with Clifford Caldicott. Well, Clifford, so you began to study the chemtrail phenomenon, and what have you discovered as you've actually been researching this and going through government records? And certainly there is information out there that this is a definite government program, isn't there?
Well, there's certainly no formal documentation of any type on this project, and I would have to classify this as one of the deepest, most extensive covert operations that has existed in the history of mankind, if not the most extensive covert operation, meaning that there is not a single government official, a person in a supposed position of authority, that will acknowledge the reality of this issue. You have a long history of citizens requesting an investigation into this issue, and there is simply a dismissal or a refusal to acknowledge, certainly a refusal to investigate at any and all levels thus far. So all of the research that has been accomplished is originating at a citizen level and at a grassroots level. And my background is in the sciences, particularly the technical sciences, physics and mathematics, geophysics, that type of thing, and also surveying. So as a citizen, I have measured directly the world around me. I've spent the first of those 5.5 years I've been involved with this, I've spent strictly in photography, not really trying to come to any conclusions at that point, but simply documenting what was being seen, much of it with telephotography, which has produced some rather astounding photographs that would defy any sensible interpretation of a condensation trail. And I do know that the essential claim that I and others will now make, and that is that we are being dispersed upon with solid materials with the use of aircraft on a regular basis, on a very expensive basis, truly a global level. And the claim upon first hearing might certainly sound preposterous to many people. And yet, if individuals are willing to look at the facts, to look at the information, start with straight photographs, just look at what you see, and then begin to dig into the issue, it really does not become so preposterous, especially as you look at the historical record, which you have made a reference to. And even though there is no acknowledgement of this particular operation, historically we can see that this idea is not preposterous at all, and as a matter of fact, it is documented in the historical record, and that being the use of aerosols, the use of chemicals, biologicals.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Clifford Caldicott, and he's talking about his research into chemtrails. And he goes into the background. There have been instances in the past where they've certainly done experiments on the American people, but they're always top secret. They will not reveal what they're doing. And yet we know that they've experimented on our population, the populations of the rest of the world, many times in the past. So pick up the story from there, a thought from there, please.
There most certainly is a precedent for this issue and the subsequent claims that are being made. There's a document that is a summary of congressional hearings. These hearings were held in 1977. This document was available through the U.S. government printing office. I received a copy of this about 4 years ago through the courtesy of Joyce Riley and the Gulf War Veterans Association. I'm going to read the title of this page. It is called Biological Testing Involving Human Subjects by the Department of Defense, 1977.
Yes, actually, we carry that to our ministry. So, but tell our listeners about that, and maybe they'll want to get it.
And the title again is the Biological Testing Involving Human Subjects by the Department of Defense, 1977. These are congressional hearings held in the spring of 1977. The subtitle of this document is The Examination of Serious Deficiencies in the Defense Department's Efforts to Protect the Human Subjects of Drug Research. Now, apparently this document is rather difficult to get a hold of, but I certainly have a copy in my hands, and I have spent some time with this document. And if anyone wishes to question the claim that there is a precedent for the use of aerosols and or biological testing upon an unsuspecting and unknowing populace, this document, I do think and know that it makes the case very clear.
We actually carry that to our ministry, so it is available through Radio Liberty, but it is, as you say, it's very hard to get. I don't know anybody besides Joyce Riley and our ministry that carries that. So, because the last thing the government wants the American people to know is that they can experiment on you and that you have no rights at all.
And if you'll take a look at these documents, you'll see a record extending literally back to the close of World War II, 1947 in there. You will see a series of tests. You know, the title here, Table 2, Biological Field Testing, Biological Simulants Involving the Public Domain. There is the acknowledgement of a numerous series of tests that were conducted upon the civil population without their permission, without their knowing in any way. And Senator Kennedy was the congressman heading this set of hearings, and he truly did identify the central issue, and that was whether or not the government has the right to claim under the pretext of national security the right to conduct such operations. And I think he really nailed it right on the head, that the purpose of these hearings was to bring that question out into the open and have the public involved. And what we find now is that we have no hope right now, no prospect of hearings on these operations, even though the central issue is very much the same. You have contractors listed in this document, which are directly tied in with the use of aerosols, aircraft, biological components, and a most interesting aspect, that of desiccation or freeze drying, which does appear to be certainly inherent in what we are finding in atmospheric samples thus far. You have a large section of this document about or written by Merck, who was subsequently to develop into the Merck Drug Company. And the whole purpose of the discussion was the biological warfare program and its association with the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, from a starting point, if you wish to question the validity of the issue, you would actually have a hard time if you're willing to look at the history, let alone consider now over 5.5 years of research, as well as a grassroots activism that is known clearly to involve millions of people at this stage, where it's certainly clear that millions of people are aware of this issue, but at no level has there been any official acknowledgement or investigation.
All right, fine. Well, now, what are they actually spraying? What sort of chemicals are in the sprays?
Stan, there's about four main categories of materials that I would say have been repeatedly identified. The most prominent, and this would be one of the strongest conclusions of the work, is that a dominant component is a metallic salt, especially that of barium. I don't know how reserved or conservative I can remain in my statements at this point, because the tests have been done over and over and over. I have laid out my work entirely. It's based upon chemical methods, spectroscopic methods, flame tests, electrolysis, a whole series of tests, the methods of which are completely outlined on the page, have been several times, and the most recent work approximately a year ago, is as definitive as I know anything can be in this test without involving someone from a higher level of chemical authority. And I don't claim to be a chemist, but I certainly claim to have a background that's willing to take on problems, and the subject is not entirely foreign to me. And that test, that particular test, repeatedly shows the direct presence of what I have to regard as unusual levels of barium in the atmosphere.
Well, you don't really have barium in the atmosphere. And that's,
you don't, it's not to be there. You get a hold of the air constituent report from Cambridge University. I have the entire breakdown of the atmospheric constituents down to the, it's at the parts per billion level. And if you go through this, of which there are probably 100 constituents listed, you will not find barium listed in that. Interestingly enough, the university that paper came from did not want that information posted on my website, but the reference is certainly there, and the name of the book is there. That's from Cambridge University. Barium is not to be in the atmosphere. Barium is a highly toxic environment or substance, especially in the soluble form. Barium, and you're a medical person, you're a doctor, so you probably know this better than I do, but the non-soluble or insoluble forms have been used for gastrointestinal studies and x-rays for some time, but the soluble forms of barium are highly toxic. The books that I have list that toxicity on the same level as that of arsenic. It's half a part per million is their atmospheric standard. And the tests repeatedly show the presence of soluble forms of barium.
Now, what are some of the other things that you find? Because barium seems to be the most consistent, but what are some of the other things that are up there?
A second physical material that has many interesting properties and also many mysteries that have remained with it is that of a fibrous or filament material. This material was discovered fairly early in the research. It had several reports of unusual conglomerations of fibrous and filament material falling, literally falling from the sky.
Is this what they're told? They tell us, oh, those are the spider webs. That's how the spiders travel around from long distances.
Yeah, yes. This is the counterclaim that has been made, is that these are just spider webs, as there will be a counterclaim available for everything that we speak of, and I think that's fine in the sense that all of us who care should be willing to look at those counterclaims and evaluate that evidence. I will say that claim of spiderweb activity is rather absurd, actually, if you look into it. If you take a look at some of the photographs that came out early in this, where one of the earlier samples came in, you're talking about a sample of material that is probably close to a half inch to an inch thick in diameter. This is a collection of strands.
I sure wouldn't want to run into the spider that spun that.
That's right. That's exactly right. This collection of strands is approximately, call it 30 feet long. There is a cassette tape on the photographs for a comparison of size, and a person can look at this material and immediately conclude that it is certainly not of a spider web origin. In fact, it has such an unusual appearance and nature to it that you would immediately seek an identification of it.
Have you ever seen pictures of this on a tree? It almost looks like a tree that's decorated for Christmas.
These are the reports that I've been given. In my case, I've received a sample of the material separately at least three times right now and analyzed each sample separately. Now, but I haven't actually seen it, say, on hanging from the trees and that type of thing. I've received direct samples. The reports are...
I actually have pictures of that. I
don't
know where they are, but one of the young men who worked for us actually saw this spraying one morning, and then, of course, this comes down on a tree, and it just looked like these white bands all over the tree. And he brought some of that to me. We didn't know who to send it to, so we eventually disposed of it, but there's no question, almost like sort of a semi-gelatinous sort of material.
And I have seen a video. In fact, before this issue really even opened up, I had an individual that sent me a video taken in Oklahoma, I believe, Kansas or Oklahoma, and this film was taken in 1998. I know that it almost certainly was an early part of the operation. And this individual, the video quality was poor, and that's part of why I couldn't really present the stills from that. But this guy literally had his entire hayfields covered, and his video was documentation of his attempts to call the FAA and to seek assistance, of which he received none. Now, if you actually start looking into this material, the intrigue deepens quite a bit further.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it is not a single fiber. In that sample I told you of that was an inch thick, honestly, I think you would be dealing with hundreds of thousands to millions of fibers contained within that sample. This material is at the sub-micron level in terms of its diameter and thickness.
All right, you hang on there. We'll be back in just a few moments to discuss more of this incredible story. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. They're experimenting on you, like when they put the fluoride in your drinking water, when they put the mercury in your vaccines to destroy the minds of our children and our elderly, as they put aspartame in our various drinks. It's a poison. They know it's a poison. They just don't want you to know. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Clifford Connicom, and we're talking about chemtrails. And Clifford is describing these filaments that float down from the sky, some of them 30 feet long, and they will try to tell you, oh, those are spun by spiders. That's how spiders get such from one area to another. Why, you can see pictures of them. We even had one in our paper recently. Yes, those are simply spider webs. And all I can say is, do you honestly believe that? You know, when they may tell you that's a spider, but that would have to be the world's largest spider, to spin a web like that, because these are not simple little tiny filaments. These are very, very thick. So Clifford was saying that these are really made up of thousands, if not, millions of fibers?
Well, they would be. If you look at the size of these, I've spent some considerable time under the microscope with this material, and incidentally have conducted a separate test in direct comparison to spider webs to prove a chemical difference or chemical variation. They just do not match. If you work with methylene blue as a stain, and or actually hair perm is an interesting chemical because it's protonaceous based and will destroy proteins. And if you perform a series of chemical tests, it's fairly easy to demonstrate that these are certainly not a spider web, at least not by direct chemical comparison and tests. But the size of these fibers is extraordinary. A human hair is on the order of 60 to 100 microns thick for a frame of reference. Most of our textile fibers that we deal with are on the order of, call it 8 to 15 microns, something like that. An asbestos fiber is on the order of a couple of microns in thickness. The fibers that I'm speaking of, which have been repeatedly collected now, photographed, analyzed as best as I certainly can, are at the sub-micron level in thickness. Now, just on the basis of size alone, let alone other properties or other findings within these fibers, just based upon size alone, if you were to have an airborne sample that measured out at the sub-micron level, and you were to know that asbestos fibers are a couple of microns thick, and that this material is not soluble, at least not directly so. It's inert in terms of its, and static in terms of its shape and size. You would think that you would have a reasonable concern to have this material identified. I certainly would. And in fact, that is exactly what has been attempted. In addition to all the studies that I have done, which we could talk about in depth more, but suffice it to say, the results of those studies impressed me enough, as well as a colleague by the name of Dave Peterson up in Aspen, Colorado, impressed us both enough that we sent this material to the Environmental Protection Agency. We sent it to the administrator of the EPA by certified mail. We included a letter that requested an identification of this material on behalf of the public welfare and interest. It took, have a period of several months that elapsed. The first correspondence that came back, and that was Carolyn Browner at that time. She was the administrator. The correspondence that came back to us did not acknowledge receipt of the physical material. You said that you tried or you wanted to get this identified. We tried also, but we did it quite directly. And there was no acknowledgement of receipt of that physical material in the letter. We received a letter back that simply says the EPA has no awareness. This is the word they keep using over and over and over, and that is that they have no awareness of any such airborne or aerosol operations.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Clifford Condacom, and he talked about actually checking some of these samples, this fibrous material that you're being told, you know, this simply is one of those spider webs just drifting down from outer space created by some giant spider that's up there. And they actually took some of this, and they sent it to the EPA, and the response was not even acknowledged, having gotten this back, said the EPA, what was the term they used? It does not acknowledge that such a thing exists, or what was their term?
The phrase that they used, Dan, was that they are not aware. They keep using the phrase that they are unaware. This occurs over many, many months in every bit of correspondence that results. This correspondence is all on the website. Everyone can read this history for themselves of correspondence. All the certified mail receipts are there. And the phrase they keep using is that the EPA is unaware. I don't know why they chose that particular phrase, but it's what they decided to stick with. And they never acknowledged receipt of this physical material. This state of affairs prolonged itself to eventually a period of 1.5 years from the original request. Never any time was there acknowledgement. After a year and a half, you had a Freedom of Information Act submitted by a third party, basically, I think, challenging the credibility of the accounts as they had been presented publicly. And the EPA at that time took a rather dramatic change in position and returned the sample at that point. They returned the sample to us. They continued to refuse to identify it, and their phrase of choice, I don't have it directly in front of me, but their phrase of choice was that it is not the policy. This is what they said. They said it is not the policy of the EPA to test any unsolicited material. This was their summary statement. Policy is basically a choice. It is not that of law. It is that of choice by whoever is in position or control. Unsolicited means to me that unless the EPA asks for it, they do not believe that they have any obligation or duty to test environmental samples on behalf of the public. I find it really incomprehensible in terms of true public service that this would occur, but in fact it has occurred, and the level of really no other way it can be said other than cover-up on this issue is quite apparent.
Well, now tell us, how can people get onto your website and get the information that you've accumulated?
And my website is under my name as carnicom.com, and that is spelled C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, www.carnicom.com, and there will be a very prominent link to the aerosol issue under my name, and that page will have 5.5 years of research, and it must now involve several hundred, if not more than 1,000 pages of research, I assume. It's quite involved. There's just no way around it because I've committed a major part of my life to this research.
Well, now, you comment that there is barium up there. Did you find any evidence of either aluminum or titanium?
I have not found direct evidence. My direct chemical test, and people must understand that I do not have extensive lab resources. I'm acting totally as a citizen. I have to basically develop or devise and research any kind of test I can come up with. There's five metals that I offer as a candidate list, at least five. There may be six now. And that list would include magnesium, calcium, titanium, aluminum, and barium. Magnesium, calcium, aluminum, barium, and titanium, right. Magnesium, calcium, aluminum, barium, and titanium. These would be the five. And in addition to that, strontium. Strontium will be another one that will be added to the list. Group 2 of the periodic table is of a special interest in this work because of the physical properties of that group of elements that seems to be very much in line with agendas of these operations. But in terms of my test, my direct tests have shown magnesium and barium. The calcium has come from an air filter from a jet aircraft, and the aluminum and titanium exist from either other reports of citizens or other claims that have been mentioned so many times that there has to be at least given credibility towards investigating their presence. I do not have direct evidence of those elements. Aluminum is interesting in the sense that it has a spherical aerosol form, and part of my work does show the presence of literally a micron, submicron spherical aerosol, but I cannot claim that that's aluminum by any means at this point.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Clifford Kinacom, and of course, we'll welcome your calls. From out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Clifford Kinacom, and we're talking about the chemtrails and what he's been able to uncover on his own. Now, have you found any evidence or anything to suggest that we can document the fact that there actually is a program of aerial spraying to somehow counter the so-called global warming? Have you heard the theory that it was certainly the father of the H-bomb, William Teller, who had suggested that if we could spray something up in the atmosphere or sub-atmosphere, we could counter the effect of global warming? Are you acquainted with that theory?
What I find, Stan, is that there are individuals who will offer this report, especially the Teller report, as an explanation for these events. There is no government acknowledgement that I know of. Now, let's hold off just a second. There is a program called TAP that we should all look into, Tropospheric Aerosol Program.
Now, do you call it TAPS?
Yes, TAP, T-A-P. That's a program we can all look into. But what it does, that program, it talks about, it's always a study. It's always saying we're going to study something, and that was planned for the future. I think 2005 is their target date that I see, where they acknowledge a research program projected into the future. And at that point, they're never talking about the introduction of aerosols, and that is certainly my claim, that their aerosols are being introduced in massive amounts. That particular program, as I recall reading it, simply projected ahead that they would study existing aerosols and their patterns of movement, that type of thing. There are folks that offer the Teller report as a plausible explanation for these events. My work does not substantiate those claims. If you look into the Teller report, it basically says that if you put these materials in at extremely high altitudes, really it's primarily space-based if you look at that. There's three locations where they talk about introducing these aerosols. One is midway between, midway between at least the Sun and the Earth, if not, midway between the Earth and the Moon, if not the Earth and the Sun. The other is, call it 50 to 100 miles away from Earth orbit, and the other is at the extreme upper end of the stratosphere, not the troposphere. The stratosphere is the upper layer of the atmosphere. Where we're talking about with aircraft is at the upper limit of the troposphere, roughly 7 miles above the Earth. And if you look at the paper, it makes sense if you adopt that premise that you're after cooling things down, because what you're doing is you're putting this material away from the Earth where it draws off the
heat. Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Clifford Kinacom. We're talking about this. There is a theory out there that some people have said that Edward Teller had suggested that they could spray in the atmosphere, and somehow this would reflect light from the sun and would protect us from global warming. Clifford says that, of course, there's no documentation. A lot of people talk about that. He says that there is a program known as TAP, and that's the Troposphere atmospheric program, but that's not supposed to be something they're doing for some time. But so this is what they're talking about, is either spraying in the troposphere or in the top of the stratosphere, or I guess that would be fairly close to the ionosphere. I don't understand all these various levels, but there are these various levels that are out there. Do we have any evidence that they are actually doing that, or is this something they're just talking about?
there is no formal evidence that they are doing it. And if you look at the Teller paper, the point of that paper is basically space-based. And many people adopt that paper and say that, oh, yeah, this is all what's happening. They're trying to cool the Earth. First of all, the focus of that paper is a space-based operation away from the Earth. And my work has led me to conclude exactly the opposite. And that is that if you introduce these particular materials that we're talking about in the lower atmosphere, which is where we are with these aircraft, this material descends to the Earth. We're talking about a layer that can be seen from 0 to 10 miles above the Earth without any problem. This is the lower portion of the atmosphere. If you put these materials into the lower atmosphere, they will heat up the atmosphere. They will not cool it down. This is my conclusion based upon my work, and the basis of this is what's called specific heat. If you look at what's called the specific heat of a substance, it has to do with its ability to heat up. Think about sticking a piece of metal out in the sun. What happens? It gets hot in almost all cases. There's very few metals that would go the other way around. And the particular element barium, it has a specific heat that would be five times that of air in terms of its ability to heat up. And the actual observable effects are completely consistent with the conclusion that these materials that have been introduced into the atmosphere are heating the atmosphere up. They are not cooling it down.
And this is actually what I would think as well. I would think that, of course, what you do would be trapping the air below, and then, of course, absorbing the heat from the sun. So, but of course, when you would do something like that, you would actually be causing the air to get warmer, and of course, hot air rises, and this, of course, can produce certainly weather turbulence, can't it?
Information is disguised in very clever ways sometimes, but, you know, it's almost like a reverse psychology and reverse agenda here that people will accept, I think, because of the air of benevolence that is attached to it. The material will heat up, and all of the evidence and observation directly supports that. The Earth has heated up, and I would claim that this material is an agitator, if not an aggravator of the global warming situation, if it doesn't induce it, if it doesn't help to produce that situation. That's what my work shows. And I think it's based on straight physical and chemical sense. And it is what we see. Is it an accident that we have been in extensive drought periods over the last 5.5 years since these operations started? Is that completely an accident? Is it an accident that storm after storm after storm is completely disintegrated when this material is dispersed in advance of that moisture system? It's not an accident at all. This material that we're speaking of is highly moisture absorbent. They would call it a desiccant. If you look at barium oxide, it acts as a desiccant. It draws water, it saps up water, it holds water, and the material heats up. Everything says exactly the opposite of that which is purportedly claimed by many individuals with no real authority or citation whatsoever. It's simply offered because I believe it has a benevolent basis that we tend to want to adopt.
Well, now, are you suggesting...
It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the observations and circumstances and direct evidence that we now have.
Well, now, are you suggesting that this could be lead then to storms? Could this actually precipitate rain, or would this avoid rain, or how would it work?
It soaks up moisture. It locks up the moisture. Direct observation will show this. You can have, you know, our area, the high desert area, is a region generally of clear skies, and then certainly not cirrus clouds in general. You have cumulus cloud formation during the summer thunderstorms. You can watch these cumulus clouds, which historically, you can look at the photographs, they have a very sharp edge. They're beautiful to watch. They have a tremendous amount of body and sharp definition to them. When these aerosols are there in sufficient materials, they simply diffuse these cumulus clouds. They fragment them, and they destroy their core strength, and you can literally watch massive thunderheads ripped apart and diffused to where they have no net effect. You know, the observations are supported over and over and over again, and not just by myself. This is one of the most clear conclusions I think that can be drawn, is that these materials that have been introduced dramatically interfere with the with the moisture that reaches our ground.
In other words, you think it's actually creating the drought rather than countering it.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, our telephone number, if you're out there in the listening audience, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. We've got Roy calling from Watsonville. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Dr. Stan. How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
Is this Roy or Rory?
Rory, R-O-R-Y.
Well, I knew I recognized your voice. I hadn't heard from you in a long time.
Oh, yeah. Doing well. Very busy, but doing well. And I just caught your guest comment about how the Earth is heating up, and I just wanted to ask him what empirical data does he source to prove that?
I can't hear
the question. The question was, is there any empirical data that we're really heating up the Earth, or are you using the empirical data that there seem to be a lot more droughts today, at least where you live?
It's based on numerous methods, but if you want to take an analytical approach, first of all, establish whether or not you accept the presence of barium or not in the atmosphere. To do that, one needs to conduct the tests that have been done and repeat those tests and make appropriate conclusions. If you accept that barium in unusual amounts does exist in our atmosphere, if you now examine what is called the specific heat of that element, as well as other metallic elements, you will find that there can be no other conclusion than that material, when placed in combination with the gas air, will heat up that air. Specific heat mixture, in this case, if the specific heat is greater than one, will have the net effect of heating up that body of air.
What you're suggesting then is the heat would be just in the area where the spraying is taking place, though. It would not be necessarily a universal global warming.
Oh, it would be so diffused, I don't think you could even measure it. That's my opinion. The fact that the Earth is 7/10 water and the sun hits it every day, if this Earth were to begin actually overheating as many claim, you'd have more cloud formation, and it would cool off, and the system is very buffered.
All right.
So I'm gonna lose you. I'm going into a bad cell spot, but I just want to throw that out. There's no evidence that the Earth is heating up.
All right. Then we'll get Clifford's response. So Rory's response is saying, well, there's really no evidence that there is a global warming, at least as all around the global. How would you respond to that?
I'm not basing my conclusions on whether someone accepts that there is an issue of global warming or not. I am presenting direct physical facts as well as analysis that can be examined by anyone that wishes to. There is no tie-in to the popular term of global warming with this research. This research is based upon direct observation. Empiricism is certainly a part of it. If you would like to learn methods of literally looking at these aerosols, let alone the analytical approach that I'm talking about, there are several methods by which it can be done. One of them involves an extremely high, powerful light. If you will get yourself a light that is on the candle power order of, call it 1 million or 2 million, these are easily available now for $30-$40. Take that flashlight out on a clear, calm night. If you would like, take it up to a mountain, which I have done, after a rainstorm at 9,500 feet. In the cleanest air you can possibly imagine, take that light and shine it up vertically on a dark night, and you ask, what are you seeing? If you want to see particulates at extremely high levels that defy any common sense understanding of their presence, perform that test. In addition, perform the test in using a CCD or charge couple device with a video camera, along what's called the corona of the sun, and watch that film. There's film in there. It's in a documentary that I've made. You have direct physical observation that these aerosols exist. Look at the mountains from you and ask how far you should be able to see versus how far you can see. The evidence is overwhelming that we are speaking of physical material that does exist in our atmosphere. This atmosphere of this planet, 75% of the mass of it is enclosed within 7 miles of the Earth. If one thinks that you cannot physically change the physical properties of this atmosphere, you have a different thing coming, because it can be done.
Well, now, was this done in every area, or is it done intermittently where you live?
Where I live here?
Yes. In other words, they're doing constantly, or at some days, the air would be clear. In other words, they're certainly not spraying on a daily basis, are they?
Not at all. In fact, the logistics of this operation are one of the most complex parts of and aspects to figure out. I've spent considerable time with that also, and there's models that I have that attempt to predict the desired conditions for this to occur, but certainly no one would claim it's on a daily basis. And as a matter of fact, there's an interesting tie-in in terms of this issue of rain and drought. There has been a change, and I'm very cautious in terms of expressing any favorable outcome here, but it is true that there has been a change in the patterns over the last, in our case, since June of this year. In previous years, there has been a period of roughly 6 to 8 weeks towards the latter part of summer when these operations ease up. There is something that appears to be different going on right now because we're getting close to literally a three-and-a-half-month period, where the operations, they have not ceased, and no one is to understand that I am saying these operations have ceased. What I am saying is that they have decreased in intensity over this particular portion of the country in New Mexico, Santa Fe, New Mexico, over the last 3.5 months, and it does stand out as being a difference from that which is established now for 5.5 years. There is a very interesting pattern occurring, and that is that for the last 3.5 months, our rain levels have increased dramatically over the last 3.5 months. We've had a very serious drought here in the Southwest. But since these operations have diminished, we are again receiving much higher levels of rainfall. The pattern of what they call the monsoon storm system has now reappeared. And I do believe that one can draw a direct inference and correlation between the viability of the storm systems and the lack or presence of these materials.
All right.
And I'm not saying that's a permanent condition, but I'm saying it's another observation that also supports the data.
All right, fine. Let's go to Dale, who's calling from Soquel. Hi, Dale. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. Yeah, I have along the lines of the observation you've made that I've noticed that the it looks like the composition is different lately, and I'd like one of your comments on first is that it appears that the Bush family, they're very well connected with the petroleum industry. A lot of people state, well, it's not just the military, all planes do this, but you know, we look at it and I was thinking perhaps it has something to do with the fuel mixture that's used in the jets, and
all
if
right.
you could comment on that.
Do you think there's any relationship to the fuel that's used in the jets?
Well, how would I say this? The presence of the materials that I am speaking of as some type of beneficial component of fuel mixture does not make sense. Now, that being said, is it possible that certain aerosols of the size we're speaking of at the submicron level could conceivably be mixed in the fuel level? It is conceivable from what I have researched. It doesn't mean that it's a desirable state. It doesn't mean that it should be there. But is it possible to actually include it in a fuel mixture? I think it's conceivable that it could be.
But don't you honestly think that really it's being sprayed as an aerosol?
Well, I know that it is.
All right, fine.
Got it. And one more thing is...
aerosol is a particle, a solid particle in suspension.
All right.
It's the definition. However you get it there, that's what it is.
Dale, did you have another question?
Yeah, one brief thing is that I heard somebody else comment that with the barium that's in the aerosol, it also enables every living thing to be viewed on radar. And I'd like your comment. I'll take that off the air. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure what the point was. You said something about with the barium, it allows everything to be seen on radar.
Yeah, there has been the question, and in fact, this will be a counter-argument if you look at this. The question will be, why doesn't this show up on radar? Well, actually, that gets quite interesting. If you look into what's called LIDAR versus radar, radar is radio-based. It detects objects of a certain size, actually fairly large, along the way on the wavelengths of radio. You're usually talking things, call it a few feet. It's actually something of substance that radar is most effective at detecting. LIDAR uses wavelengths of light, and the materials that we're speaking of are actually more closely allied with the LIDAR detection method as opposed to a radar detection method, and one will find that LIDAR methods are one of the hottest topics there are in surveillance systems that are under development at the highest level of research. Those folks that developed the atomic bomb, That's what they're working on. That same group is they're working heavily on LIDAR research, which is surveillance techniques based upon the use of extremely fine particles and aerosols.
All right, fine. Let's go to Dean calling us from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I actually just tuned in, and I was in my car here, and I thought I heard somebody mention fluoride.
No, not fluoride. No, I just commented that they put fluoride in the water, but this has nothing to do with the aerosols.
I understand that, but I thought maybe I could just ask a question. I know it has nothing to do with chemtrails, but as far as its presence in everyday toothpaste, and I wonder if he had any knowledge about that or has done any research personally.
That's a little off the subject, but just look on the tube of toothpaste. It tells you if you were to swallow it, go immediately to the poison center.
Of course, it was poison.
All right, okay, thanks. Let's go to Ralph calling from Oklahoma. Hi, Ralph. How are you doing?
Oh, Dr. Stan. Yes, you may have heard this. It was just the other day on a similar broadcast on chemtrails, and there was a comment made that there was growing a concern of air traffic controllers in their complaints.
Now, have you ever heard anything at all about that?
I'm sorry, Stan. I'm not able to hear the question.
He was talking about the air traffic controllers were supposedly concerned about that. He heard that on another talk radio program, and I hadn't heard that. Have you heard anything of that sort?
I've only heard it to that effect, same thing, that another talk show that an individual cited that was the case. There's certainly no public vocal demonstration by air traffic controllers in opposition to this operation.
So I wouldn't believe everything I heard on talk radio, Ralph.
Yeah, well, I don't. I just wondered if he had heard anything about that. But anyway,
I've got to go. We're out of time.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, wrapping up the last part of our program with Clifford Connicom. And Clifford, let's get your website out just one more time.
Thank you very much, Stan. The website is under my name, which is Carnicom, and it's spelled Carnicom. And the website is www.carnicom.com, and there will be a prominent link to this subject.
All right, fine. We've got Paula calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Paula. Do you have a quick question?
Yes. Why are they doing this? And thank you for your wonderful program.
Thank you so much. That's the $64,000 question. Why are they doing this? Do you have any idea, Clifford?
I have five areas that are consistent with all of the data that's been collected thus far. These are not exclusive of one another. They are joint. They are that of environmental modification and control. They are that of biological operations. They are that of electromagnetic operations. They are of a military operation nature, and literally a geophysical change, planetary change is a consideration. These five that I have just mentioned are all based, I'm not saying, remember, there is no one that acknowledges anything. I'm saying based upon the analysis, operations conducted within these arenas, all of these arenas are consistent with all of the data with no major conflicts over 5.5 years. And each one of these five subjects is worthy of an entire discussion in itself in great detail. And much of that information is available on the site for those that care to investigate it.
So, Paula, I'd suggest you go up to Clifford's site, because we're not going to have time to evaluate that. In fact, we're very fortunate to have Clifford staying up late tonight to be with us.
Maybe he could come back and have another program and explain some of this.
All right, fine. We'll see if we can prevail upon him to do that. Although he really is very hard to get hold of. We're very fortunate to have him tonight. But I'm glad you enjoyed the program.
Oh, yes, I do.
Thank you so much. Well, Clifford, we're just about out of time. I really want to thank you so much for being willing to come on with us. And I think just from the response we got from the audience across America, I can tell there are a lot of people out there who really are concerned about what you're talking about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Monteith. Again, I do appreciate it, and I'll be glad to help you out again. I'll just have to schedule it in with you, and I'll be glad to help out. And we do need to be concerned. This is our planet. This is not something that somebody owns. This is our planet.
And I think there are people, really, who have a different worldview. They think it's their planet. They can do whatever they want to. They're above the law. I think it's about time that the American people got involved. God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us. And thank you very much for being willing to take a stand and do the research and gather the information together, which is so vitally important.
Thank you very much, Dan, and I'll be glad to help out again. Don't worry.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, our guest this evening has been Clifford Connicom. I hope you've enjoyed him. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and Clifford is certainly one of the best researchers we have on this in the country. I hope you enjoyed the program. Now, we do have a four-tape set that's available on chemtrails, and we'll be putting together another one, including this program. You can get this program by itself, or, of course, you can, of course, get the four-tape set that we have. And you have to realize that there really are problems out there, and you're not being told the truth. I'd suggest you go to Clifford's website. There'll be links to other websites. Get the information, but understand this is simply one of the many means by which we're under attack today. I mean, earlier we talked about how they're poisoning our water with fluoride. They know they're poisoning our water with fluoride. They're poisoning our children with mercury. They're poisoning the adults with mercury fillings. And, of course, they put the mercury in the influenza vaccine. They're telling everybody to go ahead and get that influenza vaccine. We're running it out. You better get it because there's not going to be enough to go around. And they know just as well as I do the work of Dr. Funderburg, and we'll send any of you a reference to his website if you want to get it, but the Funderberg website, and look at his vaccine 2 section, and where he talks about if you're between 60 and 65, and over a 5-year period you take 3 to 4 influenza shots, your incidence of Alzheimer's goes up 1,000%. If you are 60 to 65 and you take over a 5-year period 3 to 4 influenza shots, your incidence of Alzheimer's disease goes up 1,000%. So why are they telling us to take those? Why? There are too many people in the world. Alzheimer's disease patients die a lot sooner. So if you want to do what your doctor is telling you, if you want to do what the CDC is telling you, you go ahead and get your influenza shots. But understand, you do it certainly risking your future, risking your mind. They're doing this to our children. They're doing this to our elderly. In fact, those are the two groups they say we really want. We want children 6 months of age to take it, knowing full well that the brain is not fully developed and it will have a terrible toxic effect. Oh, we're so concerned about people eating fish. There's mercury in it. But roll up your sleeve, we're going to give your child a mercury shot here, and calling it influenza vaccine. Ladies and gentlemen, there are evil and wicked people out there. They're poisoning us with aspartame. There's an epidemic of cancer. And we have 4 tape sets on all of these subjects, whether it be aspartame and MSG, or mercury, or chemtrails, or why do we still have cancer. If you're going to get one tape set, I'd suggest one of the most incredible tape sets we have, and nobody else has it, well, other than Randy Engel, who did many of the interviews, and that's called The New Order of the Barbarians. And it's a discussion of a talk that was given by Dr. Richard Day, who was medical director of Planned Parenthood. And, of course, he gave a talk back in 1969, just 3 months before Dr. MacArthur, who worked for the Defense Department, went before the Appropriations Committee for Military Affairs and asked for $10 million to create a new disease that would, of course, not be respond to the immune system and would be another means of mass killing. If you want to have the government report, we can send that to you free of charge. We hope, of course, you'll want to get the tapes at the New Order of the Barbarians, because 3 months before that, Dr. Day gave his talk where he talked about creating new diseases for mass genocide, suppressing treatments for cancer, promoting abortion. It is the most incredible tape set you've ever heard, and everything he advocated at that time has come to pass, including making Japanese cars better than American cars, and getting women into sports because they'd be much more prone to be engaged then in sporting activities, and who'd want to have intimate relationships with this swelly, hirsute girl. And, of course, you have to understand that there really are evil people out there, and they look upon us as just animals to be bred and raised, and they talk about sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex. That's the New Order of the Barbarian tape set. This is the time we, of course, tell you our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We want to remind you about the program that we're going to be having here in the Santa Cruz area, November 6th, all-day-long program. Hope many of you can come. That's a Saturday. Going to bring in some outside speakers. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, right now I want to introduce Ron Brown. And Ron Brown supports Radio Liberty. And certainly he's one of my favorite guests because we talk about what's happening financially. And we are in very, very difficult financial times. The price of oil is up to $52 a barrel. That is going to impact upon everybody's life in the developed world. But think what it's going to do in the developing nations where they just barely struggle along to get along anyway. And now, of course, they're having increasing difficulty paying for their oil. Certainly this is going to have an impact on China. Has an exploding oil economy. Now, we consume about 20, 21 million barrels of oil a day. China is up to 7 million barrels, but at 10 years from now, they will be probably the largest oil importer in the world, as well as the greatest industrial giant in the world. But at least for the temporarily, this is going to impact their everything that they buy. But oil is so important. Gasoline, of course, for our cars. Gasoline for oil products, for plastics. Fuel for our jet airliners. It's going to really push our already faltering airlines towards insolvency. Certainly the trucks, the burn the diesel, the heating oil that keeps our houses warm. Everything has been done for many years to prevent the development of our own energy resources, to prevent us from developing nuclear energy. They develop nuclear energy everywhere else in the world, but we can't do it here, and the American people have allowed it to happen. Every other country in the world that has natural gas can drill for it. We're not allowed to do it here. Oh, no. Every other country has oil. They are exploring and trying to get it. Oh, we can't do it. We might affect the butterflies or the tundra or some sort of a snail up there in an area where nobody even lives and nobody would want to live and where the Eskimos are desperate for us to develop oil up on the north slope of Alaska. And there's massive amounts of oil up there. But, of course, they've created this crisis artificially, but that doesn't matter. It is still going to have a profound impact on the economy of the American people as we move from a first world nation progressively towards a second world nation and eventually into the third world nation status. And that's exactly what I think is planned. Right now we see gold and silver moving up rather dramatically. And, well, with that as the background, Ron, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
It's good to be with you as always, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you get your thoughts on what's going on? I've been expounding here, and so we really would like to know what your thoughts on what's taking place.
Well, I think you hit it right on the nose that the biggest factor going right now is the increase in the price of oil. Nothing impacts the daily living of everyone, whether it's a business or an individual, because there's an energy cost in everything we do. And so here we have these financial markets that are really bubbles, and that two-thirds of the gross domestic product in America is consumer spending, and yet the rise in price of oil is taking away their discretionary income, so it's going to be harder and harder and harder to keep the spending going to keep this economy afloat. So I think we're really approaching some very, very critical times, and I think it's all keyed around the election that's coming. I really believe since last April in particular that they have been struggling and fighting and manipulating all the markets in every way they can to keep the economy propped up, keep gold and silver suppressed, so so we can go into the election with everything is okay mentality.
But, of course, we're not going into the election with everything okay. It's always been said, if the economy is good, why the incumbent will be reelected? That would be George Bush. If the economy is bad, why the opposition would be elected? John Kerry. Well, things aren't looking very good right now. And the question is, why haven't they done what you'd expect them to do? We'll be right back with Ron Brown. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And Ron, of course, is talking about how the price of oil is going up, the price of gold and silver are going up. It almost looks like they're losing control of the monetary system, because they can only maintain the monetary system as long as they're able to artificially manipulate the price of gold and silver. And suddenly these things are rising, and I didn't anticipate this before the election. Why don't you pick up from there, Ron?
Well, you know, I always thought that they would be trying to hold it together so that Bush would get reelected, because they usually favor their incumbent. But you're right, the way this market's going, of course, we've got 24, 25 days before the election, and you start to wonder whether maybe they're trying to throw the election towards Kerry, because everything seems to be unraveling. It's kind of surprised me. I didn't think anything would really happen until after the election.
And, of course, the thing that really amazed me is that they would allow this report from a high government official who was the chief American inspector looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and suddenly he comes out and says there weren't any. And, of course, George Bush tonight said, well, I want you to know, as far as those weapons of mass destruction, I just had bad intelligence. And I didn't know if he was talking about the intelligence that he got from the CIA or if he was talking about his own intelligence. But under any circumstances, you know, we know that the CIA kept telling him that there are no weapons of mass destruction there. So where was he getting this bad intelligence? Was he getting it from Dick Cheney? But why? The question is not what happened, but why would they let that come out? These people in Washington, D.C. are not amateurs. They're professionals. Karl Rove is one of the smartest and evilest people in our country, but he's very, very smart. He's the man who really is the brains behind the figure you see standing behind the podium, who is George Bush. Karl Rove, why would he allow this report to come out when it would only embarrass the president and give John Kerry additional fuel to attack the president? Of course, neither candidate is talking about the important issue. What happened on 9/11? Why doesn't John Kerry pick up on that and say, why didn't you do something to try to stop 9/11? I mean, you had the evidence. You knew there was going to be an attack. You had seen the August 6th presidential daily briefing, which said Osama bin Laden determined to strike in America. Osama bin Laden determined to strike in America, and the president said, I had no idea anything was going to happen. If I'd known, I would have moved heaven and earth. Why doesn't John Perry pick up on that? Why, I think it's our gentleman's agreement. We certainly wouldn't want to alarm the American people, but the question is, why is the economy beginning to look as bad as it is immediately before the election? We'll be back here in just a moment to get Ron Brown's opinion. All right, Ron, that's the $64,000 question. Why is this happening? Do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, I'm not sure I have any answers. On one hand, you can only fool Mother Nature for so long, and the pressures that are building for year after year after year are finally getting so burdensome that it's getting almost impossible to keep this thing propped up. I was reading right before we went on a GAO audit of the government in 2003, described that the U.S. is consuming 78.3% of the whole world's savings just to fund our deficits. And the author went on to say that since then it's up to 81-point-something%.
So could you explain to our listeners what you mean by they're spending this money to fund our deficits?
Well, when our nation, when our government spends more money than it brings in taxes, you have to finance those deficits. And if you were to try to finance those deficits from the American taxpayer, all the money would be going just to pay the deficit, so we wouldn't have anything to spend. So foreigners in the past, since we were the biggest consumer nation in the world, the foreign nations wanted to trade with us, and so they would have been financing our deficits, so we'll keep buying from them. And of course, they're accumulating more and more treasury bonds and treasury paper, Japan and China being the two biggest right now. but they can't continue to put all of their savings to finance our deficits. So I think they're getting very, very weary of supporting the dollar and supporting our deficits. In fact, if you look at a chart of the U.S. dollar on the dollar index, it kind of looks like Wile E. Coyote, you know, when he goes off the cliff and he just has the eyes looking and he's suspended there, and then all of a sudden we know where he's going, then you see the puff of smoke at the bottom of the cliff. Well, that's what the dollar looks like right now. It just doesn't, it looks like for the last 6 months, something has been artificially propping it up. And a lot of the analysts in the field are now saying that right after the election, the dollar is going to take a nosedive. And that could be what the dollar is starting to reflect right now.
Well, there's some very interesting material up on the Internet, and I've seen this mentioned several places, that one of the high officials in finance over in China had written an essay saying China cannot continue holding America's debt. In other words, cannot continue holding all these dollars that it got from the United States and all these bonds that it has from the United States, because when the dollar falls, China's going to lose at least 30% or more of the value of its reserves. So China has to get out of the dollar. China's got to cash in those bonds and start buying assets and presumably commodities, things it can use, gold, silver, things of that sort. So, you know, if China should really start aggressively pursuing that objective to protect the massive reserves it's accumulated, and it's estimated, what, $300 or $400 billion somewhere in there that China has alone, and certainly Japan has a very similar amount. And both of those countries, if they hang on to the dollars and it drops, they're going to lose a 30 or 40% of what they have invested. So it would only appear logical if they have, you know, two brain cells that they're going to get out of the dollar. Why would any country in the world want to be holding American dollars? Certainly Warren Buffett doesn't want to hold them. He's invested in foreign currencies, actually shorting the dollar in anticipation of its falling. And, of course, George Soros is not investing in American currency. They keep telling us in the Wall Street Journal, oh, capital flight would be terrible. Don't take your dollars out of America. Everything's getting better. Things are looking up. We have two, three economists who tell us that there's nothing to worry about. The trouble is there are an awful lot of manufacturers who are really very pessimistic for this coming year. Have you run into that, Ron?
Oh, yeah. Everyone's starting to get very pessimistic. And, of course, when you've got a whole system that's based on blind faith and confidence, when confidence starts to waver, then you're in trouble. And that's where we seem to be going.
Well, of course, you know, General Motors and Ford are both cutting back 5% on their automotive production for this next year. They're not moving the cars and trucks and the various things they produced. And they're cutting and slashing the prices, and they're still having difficulty moving them.
Yeah, and the bottom line is if the economy is slowing down, then people are making less money, and they're not going to be able to keep the spending going. And even worse yet, most of them have borrowed to the hilt over the last 4 or 5 years. They borrowed from their house on the equity, and this housing bubble has just thrown housing prices ridiculously high, which can't be sustained. So a lot of people, and once this thing triggers, they're going to find out that they owe 50% more on their house than they could sell it for. And that's when you're going to see a lot of people just walking away from their real estate prices or their houses or their mortgages. And who knows what's going to happen then. It's scary to see where we're heading because, you know, the dilemma, you said China and no one with any sense would continue to hold their dollars. The dilemma, of course, is that the whole world has been so dependent on the U.S. for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and we've been the world's reserve currency. And the world, and on average, has about 75% of all of their savings tied up in dollar instruments. So how do you walk up to the teller and say, cash me out for $9 trillion? You know, they're stuck in the lifeboat with us, whether they like it or not. So the dilemma is, how do they gradually phase themselves out of dollars and their overdependence on the U.S. And I don't think there's any doubt that that's exactly what's going on. Every nation in the world would like to get out of those surplus dollars, but they have to do it very gingerly.
Well, of course, the thing is that when you have an artificial system built upon a banking system that creates money out of nothing based upon debt, and you have the tremendous, you've got trillions of dollars out there of debt. America has a debt, according to Dr. Kitlikoff, professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University. And we did an interview with him recently on his book, The Gathering Storm, or something, Intergenerational Storm, I think is the title of his book. He talks about the fact we have $72 trillion in liability of what we promised to pay the elderly in the way of pensions and medical benefits, and no possible way ever to pay that off. I mean, America is totally bankrupt, not only morally, but economically, and the same thing is really happening in so many places. In fact, so many of our pension funds are in real trouble. I was reading an article in the New York Times just the other day about a gentleman who spent his whole life working for this one company. He retired with a great pension, $155,000 a year income, bought himself a great farm, a 12-acre farm, a nice, beautiful home, and of course he's living high on the hog, and then the company goes bankrupt, and his pension now will pay him $20,000 a year. He said that's not even enough to make the payments on the house. We're going to have to sell the house, going to have to sell most of the farm, and this is hitting more and more and more people. More and more of our corporate pension funds are going right under, and you can't live on what you're going to get from Social Security, or you can't live very well.
Well, I had a similar client in the Dallas area that her husband worked for one of these high-tech firms, and when the dot-com bubble burst, of course, in 2000, not only did he lose all of his retirement and savings, he lost his job and his income, and it's just, I mean, his life just went down the tube just overnight. And that's, I'm afraid, what's going to happen when this bubble finally breaks. You see, when you have a debt system, and the debt gets greater and greater and greater and greater, which it has for the last 90-something years, you have to keep the system growing. You can never allow it to contract. You know, if I don't pay you the $100,000 I owe you, Dr. Stan, then you can't pay Tom, Dick, and Harry, and the whole system goes into a 29-style banking panic, and it's over immediately. So the politicians will do everything or whatever is necessary to try to keep the system going. They'll bail out every institution that tries to fail. And now we know, of course, that there's scandals coming with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And there you're talking about what they pumped trillions of dollars into the economy in the last 2, 3, 4 years just to keep the bubble going. And I read something yesterday that the two of them, they own three-quarters of all the mortgages in America.
They've got about $3 trillion of debt there, and they're borrowing short and lending long, which, of course, is basically a pattern for collapse. This is exactly what the savings and loans here did a decade ago. Borrow short and lend long, short-term, I should say, and lend long-term. And here's where you really get into trouble. When the short-term rates go up and they get higher than the long-term rates, then what do you do? And, of course, this is the real problem that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac face today. But we have a whole system that's built upon confidence. And the leaders of this whole thing have lost confidence. My friend Joan Vion, do you know who Joan is?
Yes.
All right, Joan went to this latest meeting of the IMF and the World Bank. And, of course, she wanted to interview Paul Volcker, who was going to be there. George Soros was there. All the financial leaders of the world attended this meeting, and it was just this last week in Washington, D.C. That's why if you went to Washington, D.C., you couldn't move around because they were afraid the terrorists were going to try to wipe out the financial leaders of the world. So they were really almost in a state of siege, but she was able to get in because she has press credentials, but she saw Paul Volcker. Now, he's 6'8", and she is about 5 foot tall with high heels. So she went up to him, and looking up at this very, very giant of a man, he looked down at her and looked at the tape recorder in her hand and said, "That looks like a dangerous weapon you have." And she said, "Well, nowhere is near as dangerous as a man who's over 6'8". But she asked him, "What do you think about the economic system you created back in 1973? And his response was, "We did not do a very good job." And her response then was, "Well, what are you going to do?" And he said, "Well, we are going to have to create an international currency." And she said, "Like special drawing rights?" And he said, "No, like a new international currency. They're already planning on abandoning the dollar. They know what's going to happen, and of course the terrible suffering is going to come. It's not going to affect the elite. They've already protected themselves. It's just the common folks like you and I who are going to be left out to dry. And so this, of course, is coming right from the horse's mouth. Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve System under Ronald Reagan, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the major bankers in the world, very close to the Rockefellers, the people who manage this whole thing behind the scene. And they said, we've done a poor job. We're going to have a new international currency. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown. But remember, you heard it here first in Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Ron Brown, and of course we've got Fred calling from Philadelphia. Hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I have a comment that would just be exactly what you're talking about. You were talking about the Federal Reserve, Treasury Department, etc. I have a book from the Federal Reserve. I don't know how credible it is, but they mentioned that the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, conducts its gold transactions with foreign authorities through the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And I think that you can remind people, you should, about the Mexican bailout and the complete scam that involved the Treasury's gold reserves. The money was taken out of the Treasury. Clinton did it on his own, just on his own, without Congress approving that in advance. Sent it down to Mexico and then said, well, if you want to pay it back, we have a post office box. You can mail a check to the New York branch of the Federal Reserve. And I was thinking, well, what does that have to do with the Treasury Department? The Treasury is my money. Don't give it to somebody else if you're paying it back.
Well, let me give you the background of what really happened. There's a man named Robert Rubin, and Robert Rubin worked for Goldman Sachs before he resigned. His, I don't know, job was giving him a couple of million dollars a year, and went to work as in the Department of Treasury as the Secretary of the Treasury for maybe $100,000-$150,000 a year. That was a tremendous sacrifice on his part. But then, of course, Mexico gets into tremendous economic problems. Mexican economy is beginning to fail. Their money is beginning to fail. And, of course, Goldman Sachs lends Mexico $20 billion, something like that. And, of course, Mexico is not going to be able to make that payment back. Well, of course, if Goldman Sachs loses $20 billion, they become insolvent. So there is a special stabilization fund that Bill Clinton has at his discretion. Robert Rubin lends that $20 billion to Mexico, and Mexico, voila, pays back. Goldman Sachs saves the economic system from ruin, and of course, I don't know whether Mexico ever gave us the money back or not. I think that maybe they did, or they paid part of it, or maybe we've written it off, but Robert Rubin is one of the smartest people in the world, and of course, Goldman Sachs, I can guarantee you, is doing very well financially, thanks to that $20 billion from the American tax dollars. Ron, do you want to comment on that story?
Well, every time... Well, like I was saying earlier, every time one of the systems try to fail, whenever there's a bailout, they're not bailing out the country. They're bailing out the financiers in New York that created these loans that are not going to get paid off. So the money never goes to Mexico. It went straight to the bankers in New York.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, I think that I have a chart right in front of me talking about the U.S. gold stock. You had a build-up that was bought with the labor and the tears of all the people of the United States through their taxes, and I think that the same thing happened here as has happened in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. You had basically a theft with a fountain pen of people's assets.
What does the Fed admit that we have in the way of gold reserves now?
Well, this chart only goes up to 1965,
okay.
But it was relatively low until the 30s and the 40s, and I think it's probably way down there.
Hold that thought right now. Well, during the Second World War, America accumulated most of the gold in the world. We had, I think, probably two-thirds of all the gold in the world, because everybody in the world was buying weapons and supplies from the United States, because the world was at war. And then, of course, after the war, why, America then even accumulated more gold, so we were holding most of the gold, and that's when, of course, the administration said anybody who has dollars can buy our gold at $35 an ounce, something ridiculous like that. Whereupon, for some strange reason, other countries in the world wanted to reconstitute their gold reserves to back up their currency, and so they started buying our gold at $35 an ounce, and they wouldn't allow Americans, of course, to buy gold. Gold was much higher on the world market, but anybody in the other countries could buy our gold at $35 an ounce, and of course our gold supplies rapidly dissipated until the 15th of August 1971, when Richard Nixon temporarily, I remember, I've got his speech, it was only a temporarily close the gold window to stop the hemorrhaging of our gold supply. At that point, supposedly we had $11 billion left in gold, valued at $42 an ounce, something like that. Is that about right, Ron?
Right, 42-something.
Right, 42-something dollars an ounce. We really don't know, Fred, whether we still have any gold or not, whether the Treasury has turned it over to the Fed. I really believe the central bank, we have a privately owned central bank. The central bank is not a subdivision of our government. It's privately owned. And it's not that our government owns the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve owns our government and controls it. And the decisions that determine our economic future are not made by our elected representatives, by this small clique of people who control the Federal Reserve System. And anybody who wants information on that needs to get the book The Creature from Jekyll Island or The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, both of which we hold.
Well, Dr. Stan, I wanted to say that this chart indicates that they had approximately $14 billion in gold stocks as of 1966. So basically, within 5 years, if it plunged to 11, that's a gigantic drop. And I also wanted to mention that this event, this trend, is a cause of future events. It's not the... It's the horrible result of it is what we're seeing now. The time-tested wisdom to have something as a hard money, something like a precious metal, if you violate that age-old wisdom, I think you're going to get exactly the results that you see right now.
I'd suggest if you haven't had a chance to, Fred, go to my website of RadioLiberty.com, pull down my September newsletter. I think it's a pretty good summary of it. And then, of course, I'll get Ron Brown's newsletter. Ron, would you like to tell Fred how they can get your newsletter? Because I think that was excellent.
Sure. Just give me a call at 1-800-595-0561.
Give that number once again.
Okay, it's 1-800-595-0561.
That's a very, very good newsletter. I'd certainly recommend people getting. Hey, thanks so much, Fred,
Thank
and
you.
I share your concern. And
okay.
You tell everybody there in Philadelphia to
sure.
listen to Radio Liberty.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Okay, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, Ron, you know, as we see these things happening, they're scrambling to keep things from falling apart in the next 4 weeks, what do you foresee happening here in 2005 or 2006?
Well, just looking at it from the gold and silver market perspective, you know, gold went out of a bear market into its new bull market starting back in right after year 2000 when the dot-com bubble burst. That announced the beginning of the new bull market in intangibles and the end of the bull market in the financial assets. And, of course, as you know, the dot-com bubble burst and destroyed, what, $6 trillion worth of wealth. But the point I'm trying to make is gold bottomed at around $250 and silver at about $4. The first stage of all bull markets, in fact, most bull markets or all bull markets will actually go in three stages. The first stage is where just the contrarians see what's happening and they pick up on it, and it's a very slow process because the majority of the people don't see it coming yet. The second stage is when the general public starts to wake up to what's going on, and then they start to slowly jump on the bandwagon, and then the system starts to accelerate faster and faster as more people see it. Well, that's where we're heading right now. We've seen the first wave up. It took 4 years. Silver went from $4 to, let's say, $8 in April. Gold got to $430, which is a pretty good return, but it pales in comparison to what I think is going to happen over the next 2 years. See, we're now going into the
Hold that thought right now, Ron. We're going to have to take a break, and when we get back, I want to get your thoughts, and we'd like to hear from you. If you're out there in the listening audience, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. Ron, go ahead and pick up your story.
Okay, so as we start into the next wave up, what is going to be characterized is that people are slowly waking up to the fact that there is inflation. You see, one of the biggest things that the government does is brainwashes people so that they don't understand what inflation is. We all go around talking about inflation as higher prices. In fact, I would say if everyone out there listening went down to the nearest street corner tomorrow and interviewed the first 100 people that came by, and if you asked them, what is inflation to you, at least 99 out of that 100 would say it's higher prices. Well, that really isn't what inflation is. Inflation is the increase in the money supply and credit, which would naturally lead to higher prices, but it didn't reflect in higher prices over the last 20 years because you had this unique phenomenon that the whole world wanted to trade with us, so they were financing our deficits. And so we import everything, and the dollar was artificially strong, so the dollar was buying more in goods, so it didn't reflect the real inflation, which was going on for 20, 30 years. Well, that cycle has ended, hasn't it? Now the dollar is going down, so all of a sudden the prices of everything we buy is going up. I mean, just go down and fill your car up with gasoline. I was talking to a guy in California who paid $60 to fill up his SUV today. But as people perceive inflation, here's the key that I'm trying to make. When people perceive inflation, they are going to invest differently. People will not leave their money invested at 3% when they perceive 8, 10, 12% inflation. So now as people get slapped upside the head with the cost of everything they do going up, one, they start to resent the government because the government keeps telling them there's no inflation, and we know better now. It's an insult to our intelligence. So as people perceive the inflation, they will invest differently. Here's the dilemma. You've got maybe $5 to $7 billion worth of silver, just as an example, in the whole world, and yet you've got $100 to $200 trillion paper system that's based on nothing but confidence. And as people perceive inflation just as they did in the 70s, what do? They start taking their money out of the banks because 3% will not keep up with the cost of living, and they start to put that money in tangibles. So if you just had 0.1% of the money that's in paper assets trying to get into silver, you'd have $100, $200, $300 silver. And I think that's what's about to happen. After the election, you're going to see silver break through the old highs. Gold will do the same thing. And as it does that, then the momentum will build. And my guess is that by the time silver hits $10, $12, maybe $15.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we're talking to Ron Brown. And he's talking about, of course, what he thinks is going to happen when people suddenly begin to realize we're having inflation. Eventually, they're going to realize they better get into something that is solid. Now, people have said, why, we want something as sound as the dollar. But that was when the dollar was backed with gold or with silver. Today, the dollar is backed by absolutely nothing. At one time, we had, and I quote in my latest newsletter, it said, this dollar, this bill is worth $100 and is redeemable in gold at the U.S. Treasury. And then that was in 1928, and then about 1930, 19, uh, 19, uh, uh, 35-38, it said, this dollar is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful currency at any branch of the United States Treasury. And then, after the 1960s or so, during the Johnson era, suddenly one day, without any fanfare, the note simply said, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, because the money is backed by absolutely nothing other than the integrity and the honesty of our government. And there is no incidence in all history where a nation has gone into a fiat money system where that has not eventually collapsed. And that is, of course, what Paul Volcker was saying when he was talking to Joan Vian. In essence, he was saying, we didn't do a very good job. We're going to have to come up with a new currency. And I would simply ask you, ladies and gentlemen, if that indeed is true, what's that new currency going to be? And what's going to happen to the value of your old currency related to your annuities? Related to your CDs, related to your bonds, related to some stocks, of course, will tend to go up, but you'll have to pay income tax and maybe confiscatory income tax on whatever profits you make, which, of course, will wipe you out that way. So we're in real trouble. People who have pension funds with corporations, many of these corporations today are going bankrupt, they're moving offshore, they're reneging on their pension funds, as United Airlines is doing, as certainly American Airlines is doing, as Delta Airlines is trying to do, as General Motors is trying to, IBM is, of course, rearranging their pensions so that they can cut back to 40 or 50% of the pensions they promised to pay. And that people may be lucky to get 40 to 50% of their pensions. Only we have inflation. Those dollars may not be worth anything. We're in real trouble. And Ron is pointing out this is the time when people begin looking to go into something of intrinsic value. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely, and the point is they've created so much bogus paper money and debt money to try to hold this house of cards together. I mean, think about it. The last 10, 15, 20 years, anything that tried to fail, they would step in to bail it out, whether it was Hong Kong and Thailand and Korea, or whether it was Argentina or Peru, you name it. The government just comes in and just prints money to cover it up, and yet all that bogus paper money is a threat to try to flee out of the dollar, out of paper money when it loses confidence and head into gold and silver or any type of tangible, and there's just not enough to go around.
Well, I think it was really so interesting what happened in Argentina, because Argentina, of course, was tied its peso to the dollar and said, look, our peso was just as good as the American dollar. We're solvent. We would never, of course, have reneged on our promise to you. We're the government, and, of course, you can trust us. And over in Europe, a lot of people there, pensioners, bought Argentine bonds, you know, because, after all, the peso was tied to the dollar, and they would never break that. Their promise, well, of course, you know, the promise of a politician and $2 to buy a cup of coffee anywhere in the world. And one day, the people of Argentina woke up, and they found out the government had reneged on their promise, and the value of their currency a lot went down about two-thirds. So they really lost two-thirds of all their holdings, but also that happened to the bondholders throughout the world. And Argentina has refused to pay their debts. And the International Monetary Fund keeps trying to lend them money so that they can pay their debts, and they say, no, we're not going to pay our debts. We're not going to take any more debt on. Well, this is, I think, the first step on the downward spiral of the world monetary system, because when countries begin to renege on their debts, if one country can get away with it, why not another country? Why not maybe the United States? After all, we've got the strongest military in the world. Nobody can make us do anything, can they?
And I heard that Argentina was buying...
buying gold.
Yeah, buying 12 to 13... tons of gold a month or something like that?
Well, they're buying gold because they want something behind their currency. America thinks that, you know, how can we possibly get enough gold to back our currency, which countries are holding? I mean, they're at least $2 trillion worth of American debt held by other countries throughout the world. And there's nothing behind that. There is no gold. There's nothing of intrinsic value behind that other than our mighty military force.
You know, and it reminds me of back in in the 80s, of course, Mexico went through this two times. But I remember I had about four clients that were scurrying down there, investing $100,000 plus each in the Mexican bonds that were paying 39% or something interest. And I said, yeah, but you'll never get your principal back. And And I begged him to get out, and about 3 weeks or 3 months later, the whole thing collapsed, and of course, they got nothing out of it. So that's going to be the delusion that's going to get most people in trouble, because they're thinking in terms of paper dollars and paper, you know, return on their money, and they're not thinking of the value of the money that they're being paid back with. So what I'm afraid is that since our monetary system is all based on debt, they cannot allow it to contract. They will bail it out until the money is totally rejected, just like Argentina and Mexico that you discussed. But they will take us into hyperinflation before they will allow this thing to deflate. So a lot of people are going to be sitting there, and they have a 10 or 15 or 20% return on their money in a year, and they say, I'm doing good, when in reality they're going broke at an alarming rate because the money is losing value faster than they're returning on their money. And by the time they wake up to what's happening, they'll be broke.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. One of our guests, we have a series of guests from Europe, from Great Britain, who have been on our program to talk about what's happening with the EU. But one of them recently took a journey, and I think he was in Kosovo, and he had picked up there a $6 billion banknote. And, of course, he was saying that this is within the last 6 or 7 years, that actually this $6 billion banknote represented what had happened to the currency there, and the guy that was showing him around told them that the money lost its value about 50% in a day. And that's why they just had to keep printing more and more and more money. So, you know, a $6 billion note, $6 billion dinar, whatever it was, note, you know, would probably buy you a loaf of bread. That was all they would buy. And they totally wiped out the savings of all the people. They totally wiped out the middle class there in that country that we went in to save from, I don't know, from the wicked Muslims or whoever it was. We totally destroyed their economy. Not a word of that in the American press, because, you see, the media here is controlled by five major corporations, and they're not going to tell you how currencies are wiped out today, how the currency of Russia was wiped out in the early 90s, how the currency of Argentina was wiped out about a couple of years ago, how the currency of Yugoslavia and Kosovo were wiped out, you know, within the last few years. They don't want the American people to know the history of all currencies have gone into a fiat money system, eventually has ended up in chaos. And why do you think FEMA is setting up these detention camps all across America in case of domestic violence or domestic uncertainty and domestic reaction here? What do they know that the average American doesn't know? And I think that they know there's going to be tremendous poverty. They have an organized program to wipe out the middle class, to redistribute the wealth of the American people. Now, if you doubt that this is part of a plan, you really need to get a copy of the Earth Charter, which was written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev. Maurice Strong, the great American patriot, well, actually he's a Canadian, and he's the man who controls the United Nations, and of course Stephen Rockefeller, who is one of the senior members of the Rockefeller clan, and I'm sure has access to the billions of dollars, but they wrote the Earth Charter. It is the Mein Kampf for the plan, the master plan. It's kept in the Ark of Hope, which is the occult or satanic counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. And, of course, as Gorbachev says, the Earth Charter is the counterpart of the Ten Commandments. And point 10, there are 16 sections, but point 10 talks about redistribution of wealth not only within nations, but between nations. Now, how do you redistribute the wealth of the United States while you impoverish the middle class? And the middle class is coming under tremendous increase in pressure. If you have a job, why, things aren't bad, but if you don't have a job, and I'm sure we have listeners out there who have lost their jobs and know somebody else who's lost their jobs, and their living standards are precipitating down, and if they do get a job, it doesn't pay anywhere near as much as before, and they don't have any of the benefits, the health benefits or disability benefits or pension benefits that they had with their old job. Part of a planned program of redistributing our wealth and impoverishing American people. They know what they're doing, but the last thing that the leaders of both political parties want is for that information to get out. If you're out there in the listening audience, our guest this evening is Ron Brown. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. If you want a copy of that Earth Charter, you can go up on the Internet and look it up. Or if you can't do that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy, a free copy of the Earth Charter. It's the Luciferian plan for the destruction of America. Because I really believe there's a spiritual component behind the effort to destroy America. But then, you know, if God is just, his justice cannot sleep forever. Ron, as you talk to people, and I know you do talk to many people, being in the gold and silver business, is there a growing awareness of what's going on, or are most people still more or less lethargic about the unfolding events?
Yeah, it's slowly building. In fact, it was starting to really accelerate in the early part of the year. And then, of course, when gold and silver were getting to a major breakout point, it was all sort of excitement and enthusiasm building in the market. They came in and just hammered it back in April and busted silver from 830 down to 550. So that took a lot of the wind out of the sails, you know, and people said, well, maybe this isn't the right place to be. So they've been off licking their wounds for 3, 4, 5 months, and now they're starting to come back in as the markets build back up. You know, it's so sad that everything you're saying is exactly what's going on, and yet most people can't see it. Because there's an illusion of wealth. You know, their real estate is going way, way up. They're probably making $70,000 instead of $30,000 they were making 10, 15 years ago. Of course, that $70,000 won't buy what $30,000 would. But there's an illusion that you're doing better. And it's only recently when the jobs started going, and of course, I think you're starting to see the beginning of the top of the real estate bubble. And of course, when that pops, everything will accelerate very, very quickly. And I think that's what's about to happen. But, you know, the other thing is that as these things happen, we think it's just by accident, yet Paul Volcker was the very man instrumental for the monetary policy for the, 20, 30 years back, and now he's saying the system's broke. So I always go back to the quote that I got out of the United Nations in 1994 where they said, a world central bank is essential for the 21st century. It will take some time and probably an international financial crisis before we can achieve that goal. Now, that's exactly what, not Greenspan, but Volcker was saying to BN, right? We have to have an international currency.
An international currency. And I think this is what the plan is. But they are going to precipitate a crisis, ladies and gentlemen. These people know exactly what they're doing. They control the media. They bought up the media a long time ago through the loans of the people who depended upon them. They own most of the politicians in Washington, D.C., both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And I'm doing a study right now on what happened during the days of Andrew Jackson. And exactly the same thing was true then. Back in the period of 1830, the first bank, or the second bank of the United States, controlled the media. They controlled the politicians. They owned Calhoun. They owned Daniel Webster. And, of course, they were all pushing for the bank. But Andrew Jackson was an amazing individual. And he said, one man with courage is a majority. And he stood up against the media, he stood up against the cabinet, his own cabinet, he stood up against the Senate and the House of Representatives, he stood up against the first bank or the second bank and Nicholas Biddle, who ran that bank, who really wanted to run the government, and of course he got the support of the American people and he destroyed the second bank of the United States. Thank God for Andrew Jackson, because, of course, they would have controlled us long before that. Well, let's go to Gene, who's actually calling us from Walla Walla, Washington. Hi, Gene. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to talk with you and Ron this evening.
Do you have a question or comment?
A couple of questions. Number one, I'd like to ask Ron, what form of silver to hold physically? If you have some silver eagles or something, would it be better to be in bags?
All right.
The second question is, if you have a fund where you can't put it in silver or gold or precious metals, what other investment would be good right now? And I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
And are you listening on the Internet?
Short wave.
Okay, is it coming in pretty well?
Very good here.
All right, great.
I live in the mountains, so I'm getting...
Before you hang up, let me ask you a question. Is this money in an IRA or is it some type of...
It's kind of a company retention program for executives.
Okay, so you really have no choice other than to quit the company to get it out.
No, but can you direct it? Can you direct
it? I can direct it, but the holder who invests it doesn't offer anything in silver gold.
All right, could
you get hold physically?
Would they allow you to get gold and silver stocks or uranium stock?
That could be, sure.
All right, let's get Ron's impression. Thanks so much for calling, Gene.
Thank you, Dr. Bye. Stan.
Okay, fine. What are your thoughts on that?
Exactly. If it's a 401k or something that's out of your control where they give you limited alternatives, which is typical case with a 401k, then I would say try to put it into a gold mutual fund or gold shares or silver shares, because they're going to perform very well, and they have been performing very well. The first question you ask is if you had, what's my favorite form? Well, my favorite way of starting is to own what we call the old pre-65 silver coinage. Some people call them junk bags, which I think is a horrible word for it. But those are 90% silver coins, dimes, quarters, and halves, and it's a very limited supply of them now because we've been melting those things down for 40 years, plus there's silver in very small increments, and if we get into a barter-type thing of chaos, then they would be come in very handy for that. At least that's the perception, and so that's the first place I would start. I wouldn't trade silver eagles to get into bags. I like silver eagles. Maybe my third priority down, my second priority would be just generic silver rounds, which are just 1 ounce silver medallions. And if you want to get fancy, you buy the eagles, which are the government's copy of the same thing, except you're going to pay an extra dollar an ounce for them.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown, and that'll wrap up the program. If you have a quick question or give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Let's get that telephone number out one more time, Ron.
That's 1-800-595-0561.
One more time.
1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine. We'll be back in here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I believe that we are on the edge of a financial precipice. I believe that America is in real trouble economically, but even more so from a moral and spiritual point of view. And I don't think you can divorce the moral and spiritual from the economic, because the two have always been intertwined. And as Thomas Jefferson said, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. So, Ron, of course, Ron Brown has been with us. Ron, we've got about 2 minutes. How would you like to round up this evening's program?
I would just like to encourage people to get serious about trying to understand what's going on, because I think we're on the verge of something that's going to be explosive. I think we could see all these bubbles literally implode over the next 6 months. And if people don't wake up and start taking action now, create an urgency to do something, then they could lose everything they have if when this thing goes. So people just need to get involved and do a little homework on their own and make some decisions. Because our system is in desperate straits now. You just cannot keep this debt structure going forever and ever and ever without collapsing. All fiat systems in history have done it, so this one is certainly going to eventually.
And, of course, the thing is, it's all built on confidence. It's really the greatest con game of all time. You know, you go back and you read the history of usury, which, of course, is lending money out for payment, for interest. And, of course, the Old Testament told the Jews you should never, of course, charge another Jew usury or money for lending. The Catholic Church spoke out against it. St. Thomas Aquinas spoke against it. Even long before Christ, Aristotle and Plato spoke against the program of usury. But, of course, the dark spiritual forces we talk about, Francis Bacon, of course, who originated the secret society that moved into America in about 1640, was all in favor of this. In fact, you'll find strong ties into this whole international banking system coming from the occult, from the Knights Templar, and, of course, later down the line, from the first and second banks of the United States, and ultimately from the Fed. There is a spiritual force behind that. Well, Ron, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and of course, we'll look forward to having you back with us here again later this month on one of our other programs.
Look forward to it, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye, and remember, if you call Ron Brown, well, you'll get a copy of the special report that he's put out, and give that telephone number just one more time.
It's 515-595-0561.
All right. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, fine. And for our listeners, I want you to know that Ron Brown does help support Radio Liberty. He's an honest man. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, but if you're out there in the listening audience, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family, because then you become part of our voice, and we become part of your voice as we reach out 5 hours a day across America. And we are reaching more and more people, which is so exciting, by the miracle of the Internet. We're on about five Internet broadcasting systems every day. And, of course, then we have three different shortwave broadcasts. We're on 4 hours a day. And then, of course, we have our other outlets through radio stations across America. Our weekend programs goes to 35 or 36 stations, and other stations are pulling us down. People in the area are actually paying for it. If you know anybody in your area would be willing to sponsor our program in your region, or if the station managers, sometimes they will pull them down just because they believe in the message we're putting out. Under any circumstances, we encourage you to check on all those various aspects, because the more people we can reach, why, the sooner we're going to reach critical mass and enough Americans are going to realize what's going on. To understand what we talked about this evening, the books we carry, The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's The Creature from Jekyll Island, the story of the creature that was prepared there, created on Jekyll Island. Some people call it the Frankenstein. Some people call it the Federal Reserve System, the privately owned central bank that controls the American government and foreign and domestic policies of our nation. And then, of course, there's the Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton. That's the Federal Reserve Conspiracy. It's a small little book, but easy reading. And then Professor Sutton's book, Gold, for a Trade or Barter. And then, of course, a book called Fiat Money Inflation in France, written over 100 years ago by Andrew Dickinson White, who actually was the man who created Cornell University. And he was writing about something that happened in France in 1789. But as you read that book, you can see what's happening in America and the stark parallels between the moral breakdown that came with affluence and easy money, and of course the great prosperity and the stock market boom and the prices, housing and land went up. And then the system collapsed. Fiat Money Inflation in France is an easy read. It's an inexpensive book. It's like deja vu all over again, and we recommend these books. We also have a video called Phenomenon, The Monopoly Men, Phenomenon, The Monopoly Men, going into the background of exactly what we're talking about. You need to have this information. You need to help us disseminate it across America. So if you'd like to know more about these items, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our August newsletter, and we'll send you either our August or September newsletter. Our August newsletter talks about what Warren Buffett is doing and what Alan Greenspan really believes. Our September newsletter goes into the background of the what's happening today, the control of the media, and, of course, where our economy is headed. It's got some wonderful, wonderful sections in that, and we recommend that to you very, very strongly. Talks about a book called The New Media Monopoly by Ben Bekakian, who is actually the professor emeritus of journalism at Journalism School at the University of California in Berkeley. And, of course, this points out that five mega corporations dominate the American media. Five of them. The book was written in 2004, The New Media Monopoly. We're carrying that. You need to have this information. You need to help us disseminate it. And then please go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you can listen to our programs, the archive versions. You can listen to our programs live at least 3 hours a day. And of course, you can get the other stations we're on, the other internets, the other satellites, short wave frequencies. All of this is available at radioliberty.com. And of course, you can look at the items we carry. We carry several items. We carry the big Berkey and the Berkey Light and the Sanzian radios, and we carry certainly the Robinson Homeschool curriculum, the Miracle 2 soap products. All these things do help us to stay on the air. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.